So I would like to introduce our speaker tonight, and Dr. Walter Bradley is retired. He is a PhD in mechanical engineering, and I know you spent time in management at Texas A&M. Were you the department chair at Texas A&M for mechanical engineering? And he was the department chair for mechanical engineering at Baylor. No, you
Once
weren't.
Once was enough.
One was enough.
Once was enough.
Once was enough.
That's not the job I wanted.
He spent some time at Baylor. And I know also, two things I want to say about him. Number one, he's a brilliant man, soft-spoken, loves the Lord, and very easy and friendly to engage with. Number two, he has a close relationship with Dave and Karen Ness from the past. And I'm going to pass the phone on to Karen to maybe introduce Walter from that standpoint.
It is a privilege to get to introduce the second half. And there's so much that you'll learn as you listen to Walter. But our connection with him is in faculty ministry, which Dave and I have had the privilege of serving in for the last 25 years under Campus Crusade for Christ. But it was Walter and another professor from Alabama who really led the way in establishing the vision and the practicalities of reaching out to professors and then helping professors reach out to their students. And Anne, who's not here tonight, she's at a grandchild's event, but they have labored together as a couple at A&M and then at Baylor to accomplish great things for the kingdom and changing the universities. So there's just so much that God has done in and through their lives over these years. So it is a great privilege and honor to welcome you here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for that kind introduction. It's a bit more to be too long because we don't have enough time to talk about all the things we can talk about. I don't know, it just disappeared there. I want to start, we're going to be talking about near-death experiences tonight and what they might tell us about life after death. Now, when we think about life after death, we need to make a distinction. There's two different stories. There's one story that has to do with at the very end of human history, when Christ comes again, and we're going to have what? A new creation. We're going to have resurrection bodies. We're going to live in the way that's described at the end of Revelations. But that's not what we're going to be talking about tonight. The question is, if you were to die tonight, where would you be between tomorrow and Christ's return? If you've read Randy Alcorn's book, which I highly recommend as maybe being the most comprehensive book on the whole topic of heaven, his book focuses primarily on the whole eternal heaven, but he also discusses in some brevity the whole topic of what he calls intermediate heaven. And so I'm going to use his terminology and say this evening we're going to be talking about intermediate heaven, what happens in the meantime if we die until Christ comes again. And I think it's a very, very interesting topic. I'm excited to know what's going to happen for eternity, but I'm really curious about what's going to happen between now and when eternity begins. Now, I want to start by sharing with you a video clipping. I think you got some resource materials, and there is so much stuff on this topic right now, it's just overwhelming. I'm trying to give you things that I think are probably some of the best available, but the video I'm going to be showing you is actually one of the links on your page. It would be week one under the Vimeos. There's six Vimeos, which was a six-part series by John Burke, who happens to be from Austin or is in Austin, went to UT, is now pastor at Gateway Church. So he did a six-part series a couple of years ago when his book on Imagined Heaven first came out. But he did something that made that six-part series very interesting. For each Sunday sermon, he brought somebody who'd had a dramatic near-death experience and did about a 15-minute interview. And although these are stories that are also told in this book, you cannot capture, I think, the whole emotional impact of what these people share just by reading the book. You just can't catch it off. It's like reading the book versus seeing, being there and seeing it in real life. So let me start with that, and then we can begin to elaborate on what your death experiences are. Why are they important, I think, in God's revelation of himself in our time, and how this is particularly timely given the increasing secular culture in which we live. Okay, so let me see if I can make this thing. Testing, 1, 2, 3, 4, there we go. Okay. So let's talk about your death experiences and what, if anything, they might tell us about life after death. Did you enjoy it? The video? The sound was really more tinny than it will be if you watch it. You can go see it on your own computer. But the lady that was being interviewed was the director of spinal research at the University of Southern California Medical School. And so she was a person who understood medicine very well, and she was able to analyze more than most of us would be able to if we had a near-death experience in a very scientific way that she was able to do that. Okay. Intermediate heaven versus eternal heaven. Eternal heaven, if you read the who wrote the book?
Randy Alcorn.
Yeah, Randy Alcorn. Randy Alcorn's book on heaven, okay, talks primarily about eternal heaven. Eternal heaven is what happens at the end of human history. When Christ returns, he's going to do what? Create a new heaven, a new earth. We will get resurrected bodies. They will be quite different than the ones we have, but they will be bodies in some ways like what we have. And that's going to happen at some point in the future. We're going to be talking tonight about intermediate heaven. You say, well, where does the Bible talk about intermediate heaven? Well, it doesn't give it that name, but then neither does it talk about eternal heaven in that name. Intermediate heaven is the place where souls live from the time of their physical death until the end of human history. Now, there are some verses that I think point to this intermediate plan that God has in place that are very clear. Philippians 1, verses 19 through 24, Paul says, what? To be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. I think some people thought, and I may have thought at one time many years ago, that when you died, you were just dead, and then when Christ comes, he resurrects you from the dead, and I wasn't quite sure what was happening to my soul or spirit in the meantime. I think Paul makes it very clear that the day that you die, if you're a Christian, you're going to be where? Present with Christ immediately, but not in bodily form. You're going to have a spirit, but not yet a body that will be a resurrection body. Luke 23:43, the thief on the cross, the one who basically affirmed and asked for forgiveness, what did Jesus say? This day you shall be with me in paradise. And he obviously wasn't going to be there bodily, but he was going to be there in a very real way. And in the very way that Ray Neal was talking about, she said her body, her legs were breaking, all these terrible things were happening. She was feeling better than she's felt in her whole life, and she was having this wonderful experience of this special place that was extraordinarily real, but it didn't include her being in a physical body, which she had been before, and which, at the end of human history, will get a new resurrected body, which will be different. But in the meantime, we will be spirits that are not with bodies, okay? 2 Corinthians 12, verses 1 through 6, if you go and read this, I'm not going to take time because we're running a little bit late, but Paul talks about, I once went to a place that he calls third heaven, and I saw things that are so amazing and indescribable that I don't even have words to talk about it. Now, that, if you read that passage and listen to what people say who have had these near-death experiences, it sounds almost identical. The question is, when did Paul have a near-death experience? Well, he had several opportunities, but the one most likely is where he was stoned to death and left outside of the city, his body, and he, during that death, if you want to think of it, he was temporarily dead, and then he was subsequently resuscitated. We'll talk in more detail about that. Then Paul could have very easily had that near-death experience at that time, as he was being left for dead outside the city, yet was resuscitated, and oddly enough, did what? He went back into the city to preach some more. I'm thinking, you know, if I've been stoned to death by some God's special grace, I'm resurrected, I think I would find another city to go preach in. But anyhow, Paul was very interesting in that way. So Acts 14:19 is where Paul Stoning's talked about. If you think of the transfiguration, here's another example of what I think is some interesting, at least circumstantial evidence. Who were the extra guests at the transfiguration? Do you remember?
Moses and Elijah.
Moses and Elijah. Now, how did they appear? Did they come up the mountain?
No.
No, they just appeared. And they were there for a time, and then they disappeared. Okay? Now, when people have near-death experiences, this is the kind of stuff that happens. That you might want to call it telepathic transportation or whatever. You think about being someplace, and then you're just there. And obviously, Moses and Elijah did not come up the mountain with the rest of the group. Neither did they leave with the rest of the group. When they were there, they were obviously there in a form that they were recognizable as a real person, but they were there as a disembodied spirit. How about Jesus after his resurrection? We learn something here, don't we? Because Jesus after his resurrection did all kinds of interesting things. He had a form that was both recognizable as him, but also a form that could do what? Pass through walls.
That's right.
Okay? Could appear and disappear. Jesus would be there, and then it said, and he was gone. And so in a number of places we see, yeah.
Well, he did make a point to say, touch me, I'm not a spirit. There are different dimensionalities,
yeah,
and capabilities. So I wouldn't be too dogmatic on the issue of...
Well, I would say this. The form that he had certainly showed nail marks in his hands and his feet.
Right.
He made reference to that. But on the other hand, he passed through walls. I don't know what exactly, you put all this data together and you say, I'm not quite sure what it's describing. But I think he could easily have maintained a spirit form that showed these evidences for those who were doubters. And he also ate, okay? So I think what was going to happen to us between our physical death now and our resurrection bodies, which come in the future, looks really, really interesting and exciting. Eternal heaven, well, Revelations 19 through Revelation 22 will tell us more about that, but that's a story for another day. Okay, three empirical questions that we should consider. Very, very interesting, I think. What can we learn from these near-death experiences? First of all, do human beings have a body and a spirit or soul? I'm not going to make a distinction between these two. You can kind of slice of cheese a little bit more precisely if you like. I'm simply going to say a spiritual form, okay, of some sort. So human bodies have bodies and spirits, okay? Or do we just have bodies? And there are a lot of people today that don't believe that we have a body, a spirit, or a soul. People who are atheists have to believe we're a material body, and when our physical body dies, we cease to exist. I think the Christian teaching has always been we never cease to exist. I may be an embodied spirit, or I may not be an embodied spirit, but I have an existence that goes beyond what happens to me when I die physically. Okay? Another question, will I have still be life immediately after death of my body? Okay, well, will I have life immediately after death? The experience of everybody who has these near-death experiences is to say they're physically, clinically dead. Now, what does that mean? In many cases that we're going to be showing as examples, they're in the operating room of a hospital. It is the emergency room. And what are they monitoring? They always monitor heart. They always monitor brain waves. When the heart quits beating, then oxygen isn't getting pumped to the brain, and about 20 seconds later, the brain starts to die as well. If the person is resuscitated before you're in that essentially clinically dead state, then you can actually be brought back to life. If you're in that state too long, then what happens? You have brain damage that's irreparable, and you don't want to be resuscitated unless God did some kind of a miracle. But I think that it's this business of having what I would consider to be a journey to the front porch of heaven in this spirit form that I have is my body is clinically dead. When people are resuscitated, their spirit is then reunited with their body and they have the same kind of a holistic embodied spirit that they had before. Okay, what is two kinds of data from near-death out-of-body experiences? Now, many people have near-death experiences. Not all of them have out-of-body experiences. Anytime you're in a hospital and you died clinically means what? No heartbeat, no brainwave, then you're technically dead, but they can resuscitate you, and you may just, you don't have any remembrance of that. But there are some people, not everybody, that will have at the time that they clinically died until the time that they were subsequently resuscitated, can have these amazing out-of-body experiences in which their spirit is able to observe everything that's going on in the operating room, can tell you everything that happened, tell you funny things. Some of the examples are a lady who was in the operating room, or in the emergency room, I should say, clinically dead, and they were madly trying to resuscitate her. And after she had been resuscitated, she could tell them everything that had gone on in the hospital, emergency room. She could say, Dr. So-and-so really was using some bad language, and Dr. So-and-so didn't have all of the cover on their shoes that you're supposed to have when you're in the operating room. And they could give you all kinds of amazing details. Now, these were things that happened while they were clinically dead. Yet they can give you in great detail stories of what happened. So, these journeys, there's a second kind of data. The first kind of data for me confirms these are real. Because when people can tell you all the things that go on during your so-called dead time, then it means that you must have been out of body and you must have been able to observe consciously what was going on. That really helps to confirm the experience, but that's not the most interesting part. I don't care what they did in the emergency room. What's really interesting is when they have these out-of-body experiences, they often, not always, but they often have this opportunity to make a journey to what I'm going to call the front porch of heaven or the front porch of hell. Not everybody has a positive out-of-body experience. They have telepathic journeys. What does that mean? They think about some place they want to be, and then they just end up being there. That sounds a lot better than what we had in Austin with Webpack and all. If I can think where I want to be and just be there, that would really be sort of a big upgrade on what I have right now. They often say they follow tunnels or paths with a light at the end. They almost always have these beautiful descriptions of what intermediate heaven is like. Almost everybody who goes does not want to go back. And God sometimes allows that, but more often than not, he sends them back because he wants them to also be a messenger because they have unfinished business at home. There they always meet deceased relatives and friends, but they never meet people who are still living. Is that important?
Yeah.
I think if you want to be a skeptical atheist and say, this is nothing more than hallucinations, this is nothing more than dreams, if that were indeed the case, then there's no reason why the dreams would only have people in them who are dead, okay? In a typical dream, you might have some dead people in your dream, but you'd probably have a lot of white people as well. And so I think this is one of the interesting evidences. They get a preview of what intermediate heaven will be like, and that always comes back with amazing descriptions. As Paul talked about, almost too amazing to be able to describe. I don't have words to describe this because there's nothing like it on our physical earth today. And then they almost always, in fact, I'm not about any examples where it wasn't the case, have an encounter with Christ in a live preview that is life-changing. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. Again, let me emphasize, not all near-death experiences include an out-of-body experience. Some do, some don't. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the kind of documentation. Okay, here are 12 examples out of 3,500 carefully documented near-death experiences. Mary O'Neill, we already heard her story. Here's one about Vicki. She's a 22-year-old. She's been blind from birth. She is riding in a taxi cab. She had a terrible accident. She's critical, and she's taken to the hospital where she dies in the emergency room. And then she finds herself hovering above in that emergency room where they're madly trying to resuscitate her. She's clinically dead, no heartbeat, no brainwaves. But she doesn't realize it's her. She's feeling better than she's ever felt in her whole life, but something else is different. She's seen for the first time. She's never seen anything. And she doesn't know what she looks like. So she doesn't realize it's her that's on the operating table. Eventually, she figures out the girl, the lady there madly trying to resuscitate, it's her, right? Because she had extra long hair and she had an orchid ring. And those are both unusual enough to kind of nod on her. Oh my gosh, that's me. I don't even know what I look like. And now for the first time I've seen that. It's really, and she can tell you everything that went on. So interesting. She's both clinically dead and she's also blind, and she can tell you everything that went on in the operating room. A migrant worker named Marie died in the operating room, and she had this near-death out-of-body experience. She was able, as all of these people are, you can, in your spirit body, travel through windows, but you can also travel through walls like Jesus did. And as she's leaving the hospital to go to her short journey to heaven, she sees a very colorful tennis shoe sitting on the third floor ledge with some very odd shoestrings that are multicolored. When she was finally resuscitated, she was telling people, she went to this place of heaven, and she was giving all these reports, and they're all thinking, this lady's nuts. And she said, if you don't believe me, go look on the third floor of the hospital. You cannot see it from the ground. You'll find an old beat-up tennis shoe, multicolored, with some very unusual shoestrings. So they thought, yeah, roll on. They went and looked, and sure enough, they found exactly that. You could not see it from any other location except at that one window. It was a singer named Pam Reynolds, who had to have brain surgery. When you have brain surgery, they make you very cold so that they can essentially turn your brain off. It will start to decay, but if it's cold, that doesn't happen very quickly. So when they do brain surgery, it's always done at this artificially low temperature. They took her down to 60 degrees Fahrenheit. They taped her eyes. They had high-frequency clicking sounds in her ears. They didn't want her body to be responding to any circumstantial stimuli. And when the whole thing was over, she was able to say, well, that was really some pretty music. There's a popular song at that time called Hotel California. And she could tell them about all these things that had gone on. And it was incredible because in her case, she was not just with no brain waves or no heartbeat. Her brain was at 60 degrees Fahrenheit. And she could tell everything that went on. Why? Because she was not in the body. She was outside of it making this observation. Resuscitation Journal, in October 2015, published a controlled experiment in which they did the following. A lot of people were still saying, I don't know how these people are doing it, but they're somehow making it up. So they put high shelves, very high shelves, in operating rooms. They put some very, very odd things on those shelves, things that you would wonder that they didn't make any sense. They had nothing to do with the emergency room. And then when people would say they had near-death experiences, they would say, well, what was on those shelves? And they said, you know, I noticed when I was having my out-of-body experience, there was a bunch of really strange things on those shelves, and they could tell you everything that was up there. So again, now, when you're dead on the operating table, how can you make those kinds of observations? Where can you get that kind of data? Eden Alexander is a well-known neurologist, neurosurgeon from Harvard, who taught there, and he had poopy-dooed the whole idea of near-death experiences as being ridiculous until he had one. He had critical illness that he actually went into a coma and clinically died for 90 minutes. And at the end of that 90 minutes, they were somehow able to finally resuscitate him. And he had some amazing things to share in that regard. He actually wrote a book called Proof of Heaven, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Afterlife in 2012. And he's written another book or two.
He's on a crusade to change his whole neuroscience.
And it's funny because he was a very aggressive denier until he actually got to have the experience. Interestingly enough, he also went to the front porch of hell. Okay? He did not go to heaven. He went to hell first, and then he got to heaven. Mind you, people are not going into permanent hell. They're not going into permanent heaven, but they're getting to sort of go to the entrance, I guess. Dr. Michael Sabone was having dinner with a bunch of people one night. They were talking about this possibility of near-death experiences. And he said, I have been a cardiologist for 20 years. I've never had anybody ever say they had a near-death experience. And all the people I resuscitated, and he resuscitated a lot. And somebody at the table said, well, did you ever ask any of them? Well, actually, I didn't. Okay, but I'm going to start. And when he started asking, he found out a lot of people were having these experiences that had never shared them with him. Why? Because he had never asked, and they kind of thought, if nobody talks about it, then everybody thinks I'm the only one, and people are going to think I'm nuts. Penny Sartori in England ran an experiment in which they took 30 people who had near-death experiences when they were in the emergency room, and they asked them all kinds of questions. They interviewed them subsequently to find out if they could really report all the different things that went on. And they did some odd things on purpose to separate the people who were faking it. And then they did 30 people who had not had the out-of-body experience. They had near-death experiences, but not out-of-body experiences. And what they found was that the people who had near-death experience, all 30 of them could tell you exactly what went on, even the odd things they did to sort of make the experiment give a little bit more affinity. The 30 people who had not had near-death out-of-body experiences, 27 of them had no clue what was going on. Two of them had a little bit of an idea, but they said they got it off of television, really. And then the third person just said he was lying. So, a man had a massive heart attack with a near-death experience and an out-of-body experience following being in a coma for 7 days. This is a funny story. When he was first going into the coma, they were having trouble because he was choking on his dentures. So they took his dentures out. Of course, they're in the emergency room worrying about saving his life. They just stuck it in a drawer of a tray over one of these trolleys and didn't think any more about it. A week later, he finally comes out of his coma. He's been resuscitated. He comes out of his coma, and he wants to know where his dentures are. And they said, we have no idea where your dentures are. And he said, I can tell you exactly where they are. They're in that trolley that looks like this. It's in this place. And sure enough, they went and they found his dentures. Now, how did he know that? How could he possibly know that? Well, when he was dead, he was having this out-of-body experience. There's been several movies that have, I think, shared experiences of various people that maybe you've even had the opportunity to see. Now, what kind of documentation is available for near-death experiences? It's amazing. There are 101 books on it, at least when I first put this PowerPoint together about a year ago. 101 books that either describe individual near-death experiences or analyze large numbers of them as a statistical analysis. There are databases that have carefully documented. What do we mean carefully documented? You enter the people after they've resuscitated and ask them lots of questions about what went on to see how much they really know. If they claim they had this out-of-body experience, then they should be able to answer all these questions. Not everybody has that, so there's no point in interviewing somebody who said, I had a near-death experience, I died on the table, but then I was resuscitated, nothing else happened. Okay? It's interesting because there are many common elements to all of these, even though the people are from very, very different backgrounds and situations. They're from different cultures, from different races, some religious, some not religious, some have atheistic beliefs. They range in age from 4 to 80, and are from many different educational backgrounds. Yet there are many common elements that seem to happen in almost every one of these, which is to say, those must be the really essential things that are experienced when you have one of these experiences. Okay, I'm going to just pop through a bunch of books here just to say there's lots and lots of books out there, and most of them are written not necessarily by people who are writing this from a religious perspective. Almost all of these are doctors, and almost all of them were skeptical, and only became persuaded that this was so by the amazing things that people learn. John Burke's book is probably the one I would recommend if you want to read one book on this topic. It's really, really terrific, and it was his book that got me interested, because I was going to Gateway Church at the time, and he asked me if I would review the book before it was ever published and write if I thought it was good. An endorsement from a scientific point of view, because I'm a material scientist. So, and I thought that the way he treated the data and so forth was, I thought, very, very professional and very right. Yeah. Okay, so some more of these guys. Now, scientific technical literature, that's different than people writing books. You can write books and maybe you can get away with saying things that people would say, well, that doesn't quite add up. But if you get it published in a professional journal, it's normally reviewed by four other people who are knowledgeable in your field, and they're always looking for things that aren't right. There are over 600 referee journal articles in the Journal of Near-Death Studies. There's actually a journal that's dedicated to this. 240 referee journal articles in PubMed, which is the premier medical journal of the National Library of Medicine, including Psychiatry, The Lancet, Critical Care Quarterly, American Journal of Psychiatry, the British Journal of Physiology, Resuscitation, Urology, the Journal of the American Medical Association, etc. There's a huge amount of carefully documented and peer-reviewed data about NDEs, mostly from doctors who work in emergency rooms. Now, let me kind of quickly try to get to an endpoint on this. I think you can see there is a huge amount of compelling evidence. Two key questions are raised by near-death experiences that include out-of-body experiences. Can the mind, the spirit, the soul, consciousness exist apart from the brain? Put another way, is there life after death? Materialists or atheists say this is impossible. You're just a physical body, and when your brain isn't working anymore, there's no more you, because your brain is you, okay? Any scientists who were previously skeptical now believe that the evidence validating near-death experiences is compelling and provides substantial basis to support the hypothesis that the mind or the soul can exist apart from the brain. The ultimate answer may be metaphysical, but the scientific data is very, very compelling. What will life after death be like? Now, I want to give you a couple of simple analogies here about how to think about this. There's two possible hypotheses. You have one which is monism. Monism says what? A body with no spirit or soul, and when that body dies, there is no more you. Or dualism, which is what the Bible teaches. It says what? We are a body with a spirit or a soul. Let me give you some analogies. I like to think of the dualism as like a radio, that's my body, that plays sounds informed by radio waves it receives from my soul or spirit. Or my soul and spirit occupies my body and expresses itself through the instrument of my body, but can exist without my body. Or my body is like a piano. My soul and spirit is the pianist. Don't you think those are sort of nice analogies? So that there is a distinction between my soul or spirit and my physical body. And one occupies the other in the other. Okay, what are some skeptical scientists saying about this? They would argue, because people who are atheists are really upset by all this data. I mean, there's so much data out there, and it's so compelling when you have 3,500 carefully documented cases. About 900 total journal articles that have been published. There is so much data out there that it's really hard to say, somehow this isn't what it looks like it is. I mean, the data is just overwhelming. So people who don't believe that there could be such a thing in near-death experiences because there isn't a soul or a spirit would say, too little oxygen or too much carbon dioxide. Now, they don't explain how that causes anything. They just put that out there. Imperfect anesthesia. I don't think that's really good, because if you had imperfect anesthesia, you'd remember it. Have you ever had an operation where they didn't do the anesthesia quite right? It's not very pleasant. Body's neurochemical responses to trauma. Again, these are just what I call idle speculations. They don't give you any explanation. They just say, well, maybe it could be this, or maybe it could be that. That's not scientific confirmation. George Massara of the University of Michigan, self-proclaimed materialist, speculates that spikes in neural activities like those in dying rats might create hallucinations. That could be experiences, near-death experiences, but this is speculation with no data to confirm it whatsoever. Again, these are people that are just, I think, making up stuff. I also think it's funny, if you think about it, do we think that rats have a soul or a spirit? If not, then what could studies on dying rats tell us about us, right? I'm not sure you can get the information you're looking for. Okay, finally, let's talk about who gets the burden of proof. Sometimes the atheist will say, well, you got to have more data, you need to have this, you need to have that. And what they're really saying is, I'm not going to believe this until you can give me absolute proof possible. And I would always respond by saying, why do I get the burden of proof? Can you prove it doesn't happen, that we don't have a soul? And I think we need to not let people, whether it's Christian apologetics in the area, in any area, let people try to give us the burden of proof. I think what we need to do is to say, you make your case, I'll make mine. We'll see which one's more reasonable. And I don't need to have the burden of proof. This is an argument in which I'm trying to say what I believe is more reasonable than what you believe. But I don't have to have some perfect proof as a prerequisite for you to be able to accept it, right? Don't let people give you the burden of proof. The absence of perfect experimental evidence, of which we have a lot, I mean, let's say they'll say, well, I don't like this, I don't like that. Evidence of out-of-body experiences does not equal to evidence for proof that out-of-body experiences don't occur. The fact that my data is maybe not perfect is not an argument for the alternative. The alternative needs to show perfect data that proves their point. And at this point, it's on a topic like this hard to get, let's say, the perfect experiment. Can materialists experimentally prove that the out-of-body experiences did not occur while the person was brain dead? We should look at the preponderance of experimental evidence to see what hypothesis seems most likely to be true based on what we know today. Okay, so here's some questions for skeptics. Why are near-death experiences of the other side strikingly similar, forming a consistent picture of life in another dimension? Yeah. Strikingly similar is amazing given the background of the people that are having these is extraordinarily variable. Different ages, different cultures, different educational levels, different religious beliefs or no religious beliefs. Why do these people all end up having these near-death experiences that they report that have all of these common elements? Why do they only meet people from their past that have died and never people who are still living in their near-death experiences? That's really, really a critical point. Because if these are hallucinations or dream projection, then you would expect the dream projection or the hallucination to what? It might include some dead people, but it would also almost surely include live people. And there's never, ever live people in people's near-death experiences. Why do near-death experiences produce similar events with similar data in a surprisingly consistent linear order? Dreams are not like that, hallucinations are not like that. It's very O'Neill said. Why are the near-death experiences subsequently life-changing? Almost everybody that has one of these near-death experiences comes back and their life is totally and dramatically changed. And that goes on and on and on. Could these remarkable characteristics of near-death experiences be accounted for by a cascade of neurotransmitters? Could low oxygen or high carbon dioxide produce such remarkable patterns? Then show me how. Okay? Okay, questions to ask skeptics about skeptics' hypotheses. Unexpected details in near-death experiences, if they were mere vivid dreams from people's expectations concerning death, one would expect a close correlation between people's expectations and prior experiences. Does that make sense? My expectation of what things are going to be like after I die would, to some degree, be defined a little bit by experiences I've had while I was alive. If it's a dream or hallucination, it's got to be coming out of my subconscious. And what's in my subconscious? What I've already experienced. Okay? Who would have expected a near-death experience to include mind-to-mind communication? That's pretty new, right? Nobody's had that in their subconscious. A dimension where both space and time seem to vanish. You just go from here to there. Space and time. Seeing up close and far away equally. That would really be nice. Reviewing an entire lifetime in an instant, encountering a beam of bright light, God, that doesn't cause squinting. Out of body experience, meeting spirit people that I knew who had died, or coming back. Children's near death experiences. Dramatic changes in personal views about life after death. Atheists claiming to have met Jesus and become Christians. Now, these are not the kind of things that come out of your subconscious because those kinds of things are way, way far out there. If you watch enough sci-fi movies, you might have some imaginative things to in your subconscious. But okay, somebody didn't turn their cell phone off. It's embarrassing. I'm usually the culprit. I don't think people are in the audience. Okay. So let me try to wrap this up. Questions about hypothesis. Who could possibly have expected such odd and amazing things? How could these experiences be just a dream or hallucination to people who have never thought about, much less dreamed about such things? Many who did not believe in God or life after death. Here's one example. In one study in Holland, where only 27% of the people believe in life after death because they don't believe there's a God. Okay? So 27% are atheists. So how in the world would they hallucinate or dream about an experience in which they encounter God? With 90% of them continuing to believe in life after death 20 years after their near-death experience. That's pretty amazing, isn't it? For people who are atheists to have an experience, okay, that occurs just briefly while they're clinically dead, and it's so real, so vivid, and they're imagining, or not imagining, they're experiencing all these things that they would never, ever have thought even possible. So the idea that this comes out of dreams or hallucinations just makes no sense at all. Okay, so in my opinion, a huge amount of data from scientific studies and near-death experiences and personal accounts of NDE provides more than sufficient warrant to believe that the mind and the consciousness can exist, indeed exist separate from the body or the brain. Proposed hypotheses that only use only natural laws to explain away NDEs do not provide any plausible way to account for the many observations that are common to most NDEs. In fact, explaining how consciousness emerges in a living brain is still a mystery at this time. Now, if you look at the information sheet I gave, let me just mention a couple of things. I put in there a bunch of things you can easily access that I think you'll find very helpful. There are 6 videos in there. Can you see them, Vimeos? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Each one of those is a 45-minute presentation, which includes a 15-minute interview. This is John Burke's 6-week series that he did on near-death experiences, and at the time of his book, Experiencing Imagine Heaven came out. I would highly recommend those. We showed those in our neighborhood. We invited 12 couples to come in hopes that we would have 6 come, and all 12 came. We had 24 people come. And then we invited a few more people, and they all started telling their friends about what they were learning. And we started having strangers inviting us, calling us and saying, can we come? Are you going to do this again? We want to come because we heard about it from so-and-so and so-and-so. We ended up doing 4 different series. And the last 2 were totally people we didn't know who called and asked, could they come? Isn't that cool? It's really a fascinating topic. Even for non-Christians, it's a very fascinating topic. And I think that that 6-part video series is really designed, I think, to speak not just to a Christian audience, but especially to a non-Christian audience. There are some articles in there, one by Atlantic Monthly, or Atlantic Magazine, I guess it is a monthly. It was their cover story in, I think it was April of 2015, and I have a link there where you can access the whole article. When I printed it out on my computer, it was not formatted the same as in the magazine, 29 pages long. It was not only their cover story, it was a very long, very detailed, and it was very fair, I think, generally. The lady who was writing it, I think, wasn't a Christian, but she was honest to say, you know, it's really hard to not give a lot of credence to this stuff because there's so stinking much data, and it's so inexplicable. There have been other good things. National Geographic had articles, BBC ran a documentary. If you go on Google to just put in near-death experiences, you will get so much stuff, it's overwhelming. Now, imagine when you get it from that source, it's going to be a lot of stuff that's interesting and a lot of stuff that's weird, okay? So not everything you find on a Google search is useful or reliable. If you go to YouTube and just put in near-death experiences, there's a huge amount of stuff there as well, and I haven't looked at all of it, so I can't recommend all of it, but I think you'll find a lot of additional interesting information. So hopefully these will give you some resources for your own benefit, but I would also encourage you to think about this as a great way to, I think, engage some of your non-Christian friends, because I have non-Christian friends who happily came because they were curious. Now, I live in a retirement community. I always tell people, this is very age appropriate. Yeah, and I say, yeah, maybe you're right. No, which means it is. What comes next? It becomes a more interesting question. When you're your age, it's not that interesting because you know you can live forever. But when you get to be my age, you know there's going to be happening sooner or later. So I think we're way over time, so maybe we should just stop here. And for those of you who would like to stick around and have a little bit more Q&A, we can do that. Why don't we take a 1 minute break and let people who really need to take out and have the freedom to do that. Okay, thank you all.
So, yeah, we can take a 1 minute break if people need to go. Kim, obviously, Walter's going to stay for some questions. So, you can think of one when you're ready to ask. I think just stand up and yell it out. This cord's not going to reach you all the way around the room.
So is intermediate in heaven, does it have anything to do with purgatory?
That's an interesting question because we've had some Catholics come and they've asked that question as well. I personally have never believed in purgatory. And I think intermediate in heaven, in the way that people have experienced it, is not a place where you go to sort of hang out and somehow do repentance. I'm not so familiar with all the details even of what people believe about purgatory. We have had several Catholics who have come here said they really didn't particularly believe in purgatory anyhow. But I think it's still a very important doctrine in the Catholic Church. And how they would see that in light of all of this interesting data, I'm not sure. Because near-death experiences, people come back. Purgatory, I don't think you come back. You go to purgatory and then you stay there and hopefully at some point you either go to heaven or hell. But I'm assuming the idea is you go to heaven and you just hang out in purgatory until you get cleaned up. Yeah. Yes?
So the doctor who was involved in the kayak accident,
Mary Neal.
She mentioned that and I've heard this too, there was an NPR thing where they were talking about near-death experiences, and most of the program, it was people saying, yes, I had this experience, I had this experience, I had this experience. And the conclusion on the NPR thing was, well, you know, the optic nerve is the last thing to go, as if that was explaining everything. But she was saying that a lot happens to the brain that's toxic.
Mm-hmm.
Can you, is there?
Well, I don't know all the details, but I think what she says is that it's in the last stages before we die, our brain releases a lot of chemicals.
Yeah.
And that, but her experience was that doesn't facilitate memory because these are very toxic when they're done in such a large quantity. And her whole area is neurosciences.
Right, right.
So she felt that whole idea is just nonsensical. It doesn't work. And that furthermore, that people when they have something that would be purely, let's say, physiological, that their memory is often very scattered. It's not sequential. Remember, she said that the memories people have from near-death experiences very sequential, very clear, and people can tell you 25 years later exactly what happened. When I have a dream, I can't remember, or I can barely remember when I wake up, okay? I'm not a very good dreamer, I guess, but so I think that her comment on that was that these are just speculations of people sort of grasping at straws, trying to say, well, it has to be anything but what these people say it is.
But it sounds like it doesn't really fit what chemically happens to them.
Right.
Yeah.
Physiologically, it doesn't add up, period. Yeah. Good point.
So I'm curious at the common elements when someone goes to heaven's front porch versus when someone goes to hell's front porch. Would you list some of those things and how they're different?
Yes, and if you look at video 4 and 5 of the 6, there are actually people interviewed there that went to hell. The elements are entirely different when they go to hell.
Right.
There is a commonality that they experience an out-of-body existence, but what they experience during that time is, I'm going to give away too much because I want you to watch it on the video, but they have a truly hellish experience, and it scares the hell out of them. Like the famous doctor from Harvard who was very hostile and thought this poopy-dude everything, and now he's the biggest advocate out there. There's something about 90 minutes in hell that helps him accept your attitude. Yeah.
Is there any research in any of this material about like self-induced OBEs, like I'm going to use an outlook term, like astral projection or remote viewing that's involved in this?
I haven't seen that as part of the bigger set of data and literature that's out there. And I don't know enough about what those entail. But I think the out-of-body experiences that we're interested in are the ones that happen when people are clinically dead.
Incidental.
Right.
Not self-willed or, self-induced, I should say.
Well, right. Not self-induced, but more importantly, no brainwave, no heartbeat. If people are having these other things, I don't think they're clinically dead. I just think they're trying to do something to project themselves.
Or some big experimentation.
Yeah, something like that. I think a lot of that's sort of imagination.
Yeah.
But I think that if it isn't, people aren't clinically dead, then it's not truly a near-death experience that's out of body. Because it seems that in God's providence, our spirit is only released when our physical body is clinically dead.
I agree.
And when we are resuscitated, if we are resuscitated, then that body and spirit will not exist separately. Okay? Yeah. So that would be my answer. Yeah, we got lots of good questions. Good.
Dr. Bradley, I think the argument on imperfect anesthesia is a really weak argument because there's a lot of imperfect anesthesia, and why isn't all the near-death experience report these kind of things?
Yeah.
I worked for 10 years in surgery as a tech.
Mm-hmm.
Probably about once a year someone would have an imperfect anesthesia and it was never pleasant.
Yeah.
In fact, one of them was a daughter of that recovery nurse.
Well, I've never had an imperfect anesthesia, and I'm so glad. That's not a memorable. That would be a memorable experience I don't want to have.
Right? Yeah, they tend to only hear things usually because the eyes are taped up like
that.
So they only hear things, and often things they hear they don't.
When I was a kid, they used to have us. They gave us Novocaine or something, and they gave us Lucky Guess, I guess. And they would say, count backwards from 10 to 1, and I got all the way to 1, and I said, what do I do next? Because I just count from 1 back to 10, and I got to about 8. I was so hungover after that. I had way, way too much of monkey gas or whatever. Yes?
It's interesting. I'm sure there's probably not an explanation, but why there are some people, worldwide, that have this near-death experience, and see heaven or hell.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact that some are chosen to have that experience is really interesting.
Yeah.
And I guess we have no way, that's God's choice. But
yeah, I'm a candidate. I say, God, I'd like to do one. I don't want too much pain on the after side. This is one of those deals where you sound like, God, I want to do this in life. No, I think I'll just leave it in God's hands. But what's interesting is that people who are from India, they would be primarily Hindus, people that are from the Middle East, they would be Muslims by and large, people from Western Europe, United States, would be either Christian or agnostic. But the experience that they have is very, very similar. Now you say, well, that doesn't make sense because these other people aren't Christians. Some of the people that God gives this unique opportunity don't have to be Christians because they're not going to heaven. They're getting a sort of a preview. And I think in many cases, it takes people who are very skeptical and not only persuades them that there is a God, there is a heaven, and so forth, but it also makes them really effective ambassadors to try to share the gospel. You notice how she was saying, God, I wanted to stay. She made a funny comment, Mary Neal did. I tried to argue, I want to stay because this is such a wonderful experience and I don't ever want to have to go back. And she said, I lost the argument because I'm a doctor, not a lawyer. And I think, look at what she has been able to do with the experience she's had. She's written a second book with 7 lessons learned from her trip to heaven, which is also very good. She's had a huge, huge impact.
Oh, I see.
The fellow who spent, he wrote a book called 90 Minutes in Heaven. He had this terrible wreck where a big truck went under. And he had a tough life, 3 years, about 300 operations. I mean, he went literally through a hellish experience, but not in hell. But then his influence has been huge.
Yeah.
So sometimes God can...
God's using it.
God uses it, even if it's not always easy. Mm-hmm. God redeems it. Yes?
Is there a biblical difference between paradise and heaven? Because obviously the writers are using the two words in Greek. Are they using them synonymously, or is there actually a difference between the two concepts? Which may help explain the thief on the cross. Mm-hmm. When he said, today or this day you will be in paradise,
yeah.
Not heaven. In other words, is paradise what you are calling intermediate, and heaven the non-intermediate state?
You know, it's an interesting question, and since I don't know the two Greek words and how... Sometimes the words aren't uniquely translated one way or the other, and I just choose to, because some words are ambiguous as some words are in English.
Yeah.
But it would be, I don't know. It's a good question.
And how does Sheol fit into this? I know that's like the Old Testament saints and patriarchs go to Sheol, right? And are they then?
You know, I think there are a lot of things that I don't know. I'm not sure God's given us all the answers. Somebody may have the answer. I would say Randy Alcorn's book probably is the best bet for trying to sort out those details. But I think one of the things we can be okay with is that I don't think we're playing with the whole deck. And so there will be some things that God has said, I'm going to tell you enough. I'm going to tell you what you need to know. And you get to wait on some of it, and some of it will be a surprise, and some of it will hopefully be a joy, and so forth. But and it may be that there are some simple, when we get that, we'll probably see the sort of, like let's say, the back of the front side of the rug. We bought some Persian rug, and on the back side it looks like a mess, and it looks like anything, and you flip it over, and you go, it's beautiful patterns and all that. And I think life is somehow, we experience it like the back side of the carpet, you know, someday we'll get that carpet flipped over and say, oh, wow, why didn't I figure that out? In fact, in the sound series, I think, I wish God would show me some of these things now so I could really make some famous discoveries. And then, of course, God says, no, you don't need to do that. But she's been waiting several times.
I do have a question.
Okay.
I will say I had an autobiography experience when I was 17 years old.
Would you like to share any more about it?
I sure will, if you want.
Wouldn't y'all like to hear that? It's always interesting when you have somebody who has a
question.
Okay.
All right. I was 17 years old. I used to frequently not eat. I guess starvation wanted to be then all the time. I think it was my third, maybe fourth day of not eating anything. And I used to quite often walk into, especially in a room or like the kitchen of the house I grew up in, and quite often I kind of black out for a minute and just kind of stop, put my hand on something on the wall and keep walking. And that happened a lot. And because I don't know, it didn't seem to bother me because I looked good. I was eating much. I don't know. I just get into the brain and I was always a picky eater. I didn't like a lot of things. I just get meals all the time, and I just got to this point I wasn't eating for, I think it was the third or the fourth day. One day I walked into the kitchen, and just in the middle of the kitchen, I just crashed down hard on the floor, and my mother was standing at the kitchen sink washing dishes, and I heard her scream, and I watched her scream while I didn't even realize right away that I was actually at my body, because I was looking at myself, say my head was here, she was over here, and I remember my father come running in from the other room, and he was just like shaking me frantically and freaked out. And I remember looking down at myself, being a little, I would say like 3 or 5 feet above myself in the air, looking down at my head, going, I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine, leave me alone. I'm fine, Dad, leave me alone. And he wasn't hearing me. I was not communicating with him.
Or seeing.
Or seeing me, not nothing. I just remember my mother turning around freaked and watching all this. And I'm like, I never understood it all these years. Like, why did that happen? Did I die? Was it brief? Was it? I don't know. I could never explain it. And then I always wondered, I was not a Christian. I was not saved then. But I wondered years later if it had anything to do with like fasting and not eating or connection, and that's why it happened, or just even though I wasn't really trying to have anything happen there. But I guess my biggest question is, and I'm a total believer in this stuff. I've read a lot of books from Watchman Nee and Andrew Womack, and I understand soul, spirit, and body thoroughly, I feel, the way I've been taught it. My biggest question when I came here tonight was, you know, Revelations talks about we're going to be brought up as Christians and child of God first up into heaven. And the people who are gone and deceased before us out of their graves. So where are they right now? I want to know, like, where are they right now, the people who are deceased? And I know that we talk about purgatory and such, but...
Yeah. Based on what we've been hearing, okay, from a lot of these recent things, I think that we will be reunited with our physical body, which will be a new resurrected body, which is much different and far better because it's forever and it doesn't have the limitations that we have, right? And I think at the end, I think our spirit will live in intermediate heaven until the end, and then it will be reunited, not with our old body, but with the new resurrected body that God's going to give us when the time comes. That's, now, based on what I know, and I think it's fair. There are a lot of these questions where we know a little bit and we don't really know everything. And so that is just my best guess. I don't think it's completely definite. But it would be reasonable that I live as a spirit if I were to die tomorrow. I don't cease to exist. I will live in intermediate heaven as a spirit, and when Christ comes again, then a bunch of things are going to happen, including the resurrection of the dead, or being resurrected in Christ. And I think that their spirit, which has always been alive, will now be reunited with that resurrection body.
I mean, looking at Mary, right?
Is that her name,
Mary? It described everything, and I've read a lot of books, seen a lot of movies that describe it as if they're already there right now and immediately when they have those experiences. But they're, you want to, is that a temporary situation to show them what was coming? But the scripture says we're not going until Jesus comes back.
Well, I think we get our resurrection body when Christ comes again, and it's going to be different and better. Like model 2.0 or 3.0 or model 1.0, and it'll have all the things we like about our current body, and hopefully all the things we don't like, it does what we do. But I think that there are enough passages, and I shared some tonight, there are more yet, that really do, I think, clearly suggest that whenever I die, as Paul says, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. I don't think I cease to exist when I die physically. I don't think that happens. I don't, because my spirit is still very much alive.
So does your spirit then go to heaven at your present age? You think? I mean, you know, you go.
My spirit is ageless.
Yeah. Heaven is for real. The little boy, he meets his grandma.
He will be a little girl.
He didn't know what they meant, like, and when he was looking at all the pictures, he picked out his grandfather. He was like 30 years old, not 60.
Oh, that's true.
Heaven.
I do think our resurrection bodies are going to be timeless.
Yes.
And obviously, if they're going to be timeless, might as well have it at an optimal age where we were sort of as physically as good as we could ever have been, and then it'll be that plus.
Just curious, I don't know if I missed it. Did you ever say, like, what percentage of the near-death experience and out-of-body experiences where they went to the front porch Which percentage went to the front porch of hell versus the front porch of heaven?
That's a really good question. I actually skipped through your question slide at the end because we were running real late. 27% of people who've had near-death experiences report hellish experiences. Mm-hmm. Wow. But those numbers are almost surely underreported.
Yeah, I would guess.
Because when people have really terrible traumas, whether it has to do with hell or just trauma period, those are often poorly remembered because where they end up, they end up in our subconscious, not in our conscious. And here's an example. There's a young lady who's like 15 years old. She's having had some accident. She's in the operating room or in the emergency room. And she's kind of going back and forth. She's dying, they're resuscitating her. She's dying, they're resuscitating her. And these happen where they kind of get the heart going, and then it stops, they get it going, it stops. Every time her heartbeat starts and she comes back to consciousness, she's saying, help me, they're out to get me. And then she would dive in. And then when she'd come back up, she'd have the same kinds of comments. Now, once this whole thing was done and she was finally resuscitated permanently, and the doctor interviewed her the next day, what was going on when you were, you know, making all these sort of, please help me, and she said, I have no idea what you're talking about. So it's a good example of what happens. And there are other, I think there's other examples even short of that. When we have real traumatic experiences, our minds sometimes just suppress that, and it's sort of in center subconscious, but not in a place that's accessible. Yeah. So, and also, if you had this experience of going to hell, most people have been reluctant until recently to talk about going to heaven. So he wants to say, why did I have something terrible happen last night? I actually went to hell. And people said go to hell, but they don't really mean really go to hell. I actually really went to hell. I think most people have a hard enough time. I think the positive experiences until recently have been very underreported. And I think that the negative ones are even much more underreported. So I would imagine that the percentages are going to be, the percentages are going to depend on basically who God chooses to take, because this is a sort of a special opportunity in a way.
Along with statistics like that, what percentage of people who die and are resuscitated usually report some type of experience? Is it a high percentage? Or?
You know, that's an interesting question, and I don't know the answer. I'm sure there is an answer out there probably. But I think it's certainly the case that there are many people that will have the clinical death with no heartbeat, no brain waves for a time, but it can't be too long, over a few minutes. And when they're resuscitated, they don't all necessarily have had the out-of-body experience. So what do they remember? They remember nothing. When they were out, they were really just out.
I was just reading a little bit on a Google search that in 2010, 15 million Americans reported near-death experiences.
2010?
Yeah. Mm. I'm kind of wondering, historically, are there records of near-death experiences?
You know, I think in the past, even in the recent past, as recently as 1960s, people who had near-death experiences would never talk about it to anybody because they worried they would be put in an insane asylum.
Yeah. But Evan Alexander, he didn't talk about it for a long, long time because he thought, I think he was crazy because he was an atheist.
Yeah.
So he didn't want to, I mean, that was part of his book that he just didn't want to say anything.
Well, in the first book that came out, Life After Life, the guy spent 30 years getting enough examples of people who had these experiences that he could begin to put together a sort of a coherent picture. Because I think each one probably has its own distinctives, and I think you need, it's like trying to make a graph with one data point. You know, the more data points you have, the more you can see what are the common elements. And so, but I think his problem was that there were probably people having these kinds of experiences. But trust me, nobody was talking about it in those days. They were more quick to put people in mental institutions to say, oh, you're in that case, we're just going to lock you up and throw away the key, right? And,
The story of the woman who was born blind.
Yeah.
Had no idea what she looked like.
Yeah.
Kind of reminded me of Transfiguration. It makes me wonder, how did they know there was Moses and Elijah? They didn't know what they looked like, right? Unless Jesus told them.
That's actually a good point, and you're right. They wouldn't have recognized them my physicality. Maybe they came and said who they were, or either Jesus knew who they were. But it's a good point. And, but the fact that they sort of appeared and then they disappeared. Makes it sound like they were doing the kind of things that people who have near-death experiences, and they say, well, they think about being there, and then they're there, and then they get there.
I think of mercy.
Okay, well, I think the magnet only sort of what it seeks to endure, we probably exceeded that limit first.
Thank you.
So, appreciate